This episode of the Amp Hour is sponsored by Rohde & Schwarz, a leading manufacturer of value instruments designed to help you maximize your bench's performance for everyday applications. They just announced an industry first, complete solutions with all the upgrades upfront for one price. Now through December 31st, save up to $10,000 on Rohde & Schwarz solution packages that come with fully loaded test and measurement instruments right from the start. When you invest in Rohde & Schwarz products, you get the highest quality engineering, plus all the bandwidth, channels, inputs, memory interfaces, and signal generation you'll ever need. Learn more about Rohde & Schwarz value instruments and this limited-time promotion at askanengineer.us. That's askanengineer.us. This is the Amp Hour Podcast. Released June 9th, 2019. Episode 446. An interview with Pete Bevilacqua. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
Hey, and I'm Pete Bevilacqua of AntennaTheory.com.
Hey, Pete, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are
it's
you?
It's good to talk to you. I've been scouring the internet to learn more about RF these days, and came upon your site and remembered that I know this guy. Yeah. I'd met you. You gave a talk at HDDG back a couple years ago now.
Yeah, that was fun. I was building a VNA, so vector network analyzer. It's actually one of the most critical tools for measuring RF or antenna. Mm-hmm. So I was just kind of frustrated at the super high cost, decided to build my own, and ended up hanging out with you guys for a while.
Yeah, that's good. It's a great talk. We'll definitely link it in as well. Let's start back. How did you get into this? So you are an antenna designer
yes.
for various. So can you list some of the places you've designed antennas in the past?
Yeah. So I worked at Boeing originally doing defense, and antenna design there is more about like minimizing coupling between antenna systems as opposed to design, because they just have mm-hmm. a lot of space. Then I went to Apple, was there for several years, worked on the Mac Mini and bunch of different iPhones, some other stuff. Was at Nest for a while, did different things there, and worked on some wearables as well. So a lot of consumer electronics mainly, mm-hmm. But familiar with defense and other various applications.
Yeah. And so did you get started at the beginning of your career? Like, were you always like, no, RF's where it's at, that's where I'm going into? Like, where did you get started in all this?
So taking it from the time I started as like going into electrical engineering, like I really liked like electromagnetics. And mm-hmm. so I was just kind of drawn to that. I like that more than like circuit design, for instance. So I kind of liked just the math-based problem solving. I thought it was cool. And yeah. I didn't know much about antennas at the time, but so I was taking like those classes as an undergrad. I went to Stanford for my master's and I took an antenna class, but it was really bad.
Oh, really?
I came out of there and I remember thinking like, I don't know much about antennas, because it was really theoretical. It was like,
sure,
here's a show that the fields from a small loop antenna are the same as a small dipole antenna if you switched H and E. And it's like, okay, that's cool. Can I design an antenna? Nope.
Yeah, like, what do I need to do this in the real world, right?
Well, and just the fact that like, you take the class and you do well, but you come out and it's like, do I know how to put an antenna in a phone? And the answer is no.
Mm, yeah.
And so I was kind of into signal processing for a while, and it just so happened I ended up at Arizona State, and there's a famous antenna professor, Balanis, who wrote like an antenna textbook. So I started chatting with him and ended up joining his research group. And so my PhD is like able to combine like signal processing stuff, like convex optimization techniques, to antenna array optimization, and ended up fitting together really well. So I was able to kind of merge two fields in a way that hadn't quite intersected yet. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I loved antennas or knew that I was going to do antennas. It was I had an interest in electromagnetics, and then antenna opportunities just started coming up. So then when I was looking for work, like Boeing Antenna Engineer was there. And, you know, just kept going.
yeah, that's great. So tell me about ASU. I mean, so the research, I didn't quite understand what you were talking about there. So the convex piece, what was that?
Yeah, so at Stanford, they have like a really big convex optimization program, or like the leader in convex optimization research works there, and it's part of the EE department. It's basically like a really kind of general class of problems where you can guarantee a global optimum solution if you can frame a problem in a certain way, which is convex. So like optimization's problem are basically like minimize an objective function subject to some constraint. And a convex optimization problem means the objective function is convex and the constraint set forms a convex set. With those two properties, it's actually really like broad class of problems, and you can guarantee a global optimal solution, which is super useful. So anyway, so when I went to Arizona State, I started working on antenna arrays and figuring out like how can we make the lowest possible, you know, side lobes given a beam width for a fixed number of elements or whatever. I was able to apply this, you know, convex stuff to antennas and, you know, write some cool papers.
Yeah, and so that's kind of the pairing up that what sounds like very theoretical, the convex optimization, with the practical, like you're saying. Could you give some more examples of how the convex optimization might be used in the real world, like on a daily basis?
It's used a ton in signal processing. So finding weights that, like, there's probably optimization algorithms and, you know, all the, you know, how our voice is being processed right now.
Oh, yeah. Void codec or something.
Yeah. So, I'm not super familiar with like all the applications, but you know, at least in for antenna arrays, we're able to apply it to you know, determining optimum weights and corresponding optimum positions that work together.
Okay, and does this relate to like matrix math around the optimizations? Is that the convex piece?
Well, so if you have like a constraint set like AX is less than or equal to B, where X is your you know, variables you're optimizing over, that's like linear optimization. So there's like a whole set of optimization problems called linear that are linear programs. And so then you would have like matrix constraints and stuff. So convex is just a bit more general than that.
Okay. That's great. Yeah. Cause it's interesting to me. Like, I feel like a lot of the math that is inside of like a lot of the field solvers and all the stuff that's out there, it's kind of hidden from people that are using them on a daily basis, but having that like low level understanding, like you're talking about, could be really useful from knowing what to tweak and how to tweak it.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay. So, Boeing, I've heard of this Boeing.
yeah.
So you mentioned that it was like about making sure that you don't interfere with one radius
to
the next.
Particularly like on the defense side. So, okay. You know, so they'll be like, oh, we want to take a certain airplane and we want to add like 20 antenna systems to it.
Oh my God.
You know, because that's what they do, right? They have just a ton of radars and communication systems with everything, like all sorts of GPS stuff, just, you know, satellite community, every communication system you can think of, they'll put on there. And so an airplane is pretty big. So, you know, you're not necessarily like space constrained. So like what we would do there is we spent a lot of time like, okay, if we put the antennas here, this is our field of view. And so it's like what locations are not obscured by the wing or, you know, tail or whatever. And then figure out like, okay, what's the coupling between these two systems? Because that'll determine like whether they can work at the same time, you know, coexistence, or what level of filtering you need to enable them to work at the same time.
Okay. Yeah. And like what are some of the frequency ranges that we're like talking about here, like
for military, always say DC to daylight, but what that means is like, you know, I would say like 20 megahertz on the low end to like 40 gigahertz or a little bit higher on the high end.
But yeah, wow, okay, and that was the same thing where you had to figure out like is the 20 megahertz interfering with 40 gigahertz and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, in that case, there's so much frequency space, you're probably okay. But like some of the radars would have like, you know, blast like kilowatts of power, which is
right.
You know, 60 dBm. Then we have like a radio next to it whose sensitivity is like minus 110 dBm, for instance, and you know, so you might have you know, need like 200 dB of filtering or something. And that's right. Where you're like, okay, we can't operate these systems at the same time.
Right. Hmm. Yeah. And I mean, so you also run the Antenna Theory website and stuff like that. And
yeah.
So like when you are thinking about getting people started in this kind of stuff too, like, so just talking about like filtering and antenna theory and everything else, you know, where do you usually have people start? So like that question I just had about like, you know, low frequency versus high frequency and how they interact and stuff like that. Like how is it you know, where do you usually tell people to kind of, to get into that element of things?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say like everyone's going to start with a specific problem and then kind of dig into it there. So like a lot of people are like, hey, I want to put a Bluetooth antenna in my device. And so there you want to understand like just the fundamental rules of antenna design. Like, hey, having a half wavelength is good. Don't put metal right behind your antenna. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. you know, if you're on the other side, like RF, where you're like, hey, I want to know if two systems work at the same time, then you say, okay, well, here's the two frequencies, you know, figure out like what the roll off of the transmitter is from your data sheet and what the sensitivity is on the other side, figure out like what level of filtering there is, you know, search DigiKey to see if you can find a filter with those parameters. You know, mm-hmm. So a lot of it is like, you have to start like with the specific problem in mind, like the whole, mm-hmm. you know, like if you just want to learn antennas in general, then yeah, I'd say go to the antennatheory.com and just start flipping through it and learn the basics so you know mm-hmm. like the terminology and what's key. But if you're doing a specific problem, I would say, hey, just see how far you can get and then start pinging people from there.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. Okay. Yeah, I mean, because people that listen to this show are kind of all over the map. We have some people who are absolute beginners and some people that are listening to you and being like, yeah, I do what Pete does. So it's always an interesting mix as well. You try and give people a good basis to start from. When you approach a problem though, as well, so say like, let's just use the Bluetooth example there.
Yeah.
When you approach a problem, does it start from a place of practical or does it start from more of a place of math? Like, and you specifically as a, you
definitely
know, as an expert
practical. So like, okay. If I need to put a Bluetooth antenna in a product and there's no constraints, like it's some plastic small thing and I can do whatever I want, then you don't need anybody with any level of intelligence, right? It's simple.
All right.
Like the rule number one.
This sounds like me.
Do not make anything hard that does not need to be hard. Yeah. So like there's nothing wrong with going to DigiKey, typing, you know, Bluetooth antenna or whatever, putting that on your PCB and then following like the keep outs for, mm-hmm. you know, what's on the PCB. Like that works.
Yeah.
So there's no reason that you don't need to do that. And Bluetooth is kind of pretty robust in the sense that, you know, if you're only trying to go 10 feet, you're going to have more than enough link budget. It's not going to mm-hmm. be that big. Don't make it hard.
Got it.
But it's like when you start like packing multiple systems in a product or you have very small keep out, you're trying to, you know, you might have like metal in the product. That's when things can get very difficult, you know. Okay. It's like when you're really trying to integrate a lot of different systems or really push the envelope on tight integration, that's when it becomes hard.
Right.
But just if someone's like, hey, let's put a Bluetooth antenna in a product, that doesn't necessarily need to be hard. It could be very simple.
Okay. Yeah, that's great advice then. And I think the hard stuff like you were talking about, it sounds like that's kind of what you get paid for as an antenna designer, as an antenna engineer. You're digging in you're probably still applying a lot of that practical knowledge that you have, but then you're like, okay, now we're in a corner case and now we have to do testing and now we have to do this and that.
Well, the one piece of math is, you know, whatever technology you're using, Bluetooth, GPS, cellular, you want to know like what the lowest frequency is that you're using.
Uh-huh.
So if GPS is 1.575 gigahertz or whatever. So the antenna engineer immediately thinks, oh, okay, that's like 3.5, 3.75 inches or whatever for a half wavelength. So I'm immediately thinking, okay, that's about the size that I need for a decent radiator. So if someone comes in with like a product the size of like a quarter and they want GPS in there, then
right.
I know they're going to have huge efficiency problems.
Got it.
And so efficiency, by the way, is just your ratio of how much power you're putting into the antenna versus how much it actually radiates.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the key parameter in antennas is efficiency.
Right. And that's probably also pushing back into like how much like if you're on a plane, right, and you have, you know, a generator on board, you probably have a lot more power available than like a tiny Bluetooth device, right?
Up to like, again, FCC limits, right? So you can't take it Bluetooth device and put out, you know, 2 watts, for instance, it won't let you do that.
Right. I just mean that, like, if you have a 10% efficient antenna and you put in, you have to put in like a watt in order to get out 100 milliwatts, like, you're burning 900 milliwatts in that case. And you could do it even with a low efficiency antenna, right?
Yeah. For Bluetooth, yeah, you're fine. Okay. The link budget, okay, we're talking like a decent link budget for Bluetooth is like 100 dB. Might have plus 10 dBm output power. That's what, 10 milliwatts. And the sensitivity on the other side is minus 90 dBm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can get away with a lot of, you know, sketchiness a little bit. And then you mentioned something about percent. So that leads me to a rant I must give is
okay.
Everything in RF is dB. So you have the output power, dB, dBm, whatever. And then you have the loss or the path loss. It's always like 90 dB or something. Then you get to the RF side and you have an LNA with, 10 dB of gain, and then insertion loss of a filter of 3 dB. And then you get to the antenna and all of a sudden it's percent. So that to me, I don't like it for that reason. So I always say antenna antenna efficiency and dB, just because everything is dB. So I don't know mm-hmm. why they use percent. So really it should be antenna efficiency should be insertion loss or whatever. And then the other thing I don't like about efficiency is if you're talking to someone and they're like, oh, how much will this change affect your antenna? They'll say, oh, it's just a couple percent. That actually mm-hmm. doesn't mean anything, because if you're going from like 2% to 4%, that's 3 dB. But if you're going from like 90% to 92%, that's nothing.
Right.
So
right.
So for those two reasons, I'm always like, no, don't say it in percent.
Yeah, that's good. That's good to know. And I've been reading that book. I think I mentioned on the show by Tom Lee, the Planar Microwave book. And he brought up something there. It was like dB is always capitalized because the B is Bell, as in like Alexander Graham Bell. And I was like, oh my God, like that one little thing. I was like, oh yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I was wondering why it was like that. So capitalize your B's, folks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and so you work in, you know, decibels all the time. I mean, is that kind of how you think about the world now in terms of like the.
Yes. Including like meetings. Scale? Like I'll be like, this meeting is 3 dB too long. So like, yeah, I use dB for almost everything.
Okay. How does that end up impacting like your, are there any times when you, aside from what you said, like the efficiency stuff being like percentage and that, is there anything else in the field that is linear or non-logarithmic like that?
In RF, it's like literally all dB. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'm just switching into that mode for me has been interesting, like thinking about it like that, because it's kind of foreign just in terms of like thinking like that. But it's, you know, there obviously it's filter theory too. It is other places, but it's a little bit foreign for me, and switching into that mode is tough.
So yeah.
So going back to Boeing, like so now we're talking about a plane. You've got 20 different antennas on there.
Yeah.
So now you, as an antenna engineer, what is your daily kind of task look like? Is it, you know, are you designing custom antennas? Is it testing what's out there?
So Boeing, yeah, you don't really design the antennas. You're more, so we'll be like, okay, here's a system with a big radar and here's a system that's a receiver. You know, if we put them, you know, like, on these two locations on the fuselage, then the isolation will be, you know, 60 dB or whatever. So then we can feed that information over and they're like, okay, we can either get enough filtering or we need more isolation between the antennas, which means change the placement and try again. Or figure out like, hey, these two systems aren't going to work at the same time. So let's not even try to use 100 dB of filtering. Let's just blank one or the other. So that's kind of an example.
And so like blanking, you mean like when one's on, the other one has to be off, that kind of thing?
Correct.
Okay. That's cool. And you mentioned you never really design antennas.
At Boeing, yeah.
Oh, okay.
A lot of antennas in my, I put a lot of antennas in products, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we'll definitely get to that too. Why is it not the case at Boeing? Is it because of the constraints on the design itself?
I guess you don't necessarily, I mean, you don't need to design an antenna because, like if you're putting an antenna in an iPhone, there's no way you can type iPhone antenna into Google, buy one, and then start using that, for instance. Like it's integrated into the chassis, into the product. You have to factor in every component in there when you're designing it. Whereas at Boeing, you can type, hey, I need a 1 to 18 gigahertz circular polarized spiral antenna. You can type that into Google and get a few different options and then buy it and take it from there.
Okay.
So it's kind of like, yeah, you can make things hard, but you don't necessarily need to.
Got it. So if it was like a very, very, very tiny airplane, then maybe you'd have to do it because you'd be etching the antenna onto the wing or whatever it is. But because in this case, it's huge enough that you just buy
it. I mean, if you were like, look, there's no, like, I only have this size window for the antenna. We cannot find that, so therefore we need to design our own. That's a valid reason.
Okay. All right. Yeah, it is kind of like coming into shape of like the constraints you're dealing with. It's like other stuff being in the way, the total size you have, the frequencies you're working with. Are there other constraints that you thought about at Boeing that maybe you didn't have to think about at the consumer level products?
Well, the power is much higher.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
For radars. So they have different like classes of, you know, amplifiers and all that. I don't know, like in consumer, you're always much more worried about FCC limits, whereas like if you're working on the defense side, they don't have that as much.
Right.
They get their own frequency bands. And
that's right.
They have their own GPS frequencies and all that.
Oh, I didn't actually know that. Okay.
Yeah, there's like military band for GPS.
That's cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. And then what about like, so you had mentioned like the polarization and like the directionality of an antenna as well. Like when you are Googling around and you're shopping for an antenna, like is it, how is that kind of decision-making process made, at least in that case of,
Okay. So the first thing is, you know, do you want a high gain antenna? And so, you know, if you're working at Boeing and you know, like you're communicating a point to point link and you know the direction of the other, antenna you're communicating with, then yes, you want high gain. If you're making a router and it's talking to an iPhone, you don't want the iPhone or the router to have a high gain antenna. And that's because high gain means directional. And so if you don't know where the other side is, you kind of just want to spew energy everywhere.
Okay.
So and, gain.
Can you define the high gain in that context as well? Because I think about high gain just generally of like, okay, you're adding power to this thing, but you're saying it more of a like a directionality and like a focusing.
So gain specifically is efficiency in dB plus the directivity in dB. So for an example, you have efficiency of -3, directivity is always positive. Let's say it's 6, then your gain is 3 dB. So -3 plus 6, gain is 3.
Okay. So
like in consumer, high gain is like more than 6. And the reason gain is actually bad is one, you're making the antenna more directional, which isn't great. You don't want it to work in one direction and not another. And then the other is just FCC cert. So like a lot of the, you know, rules require like, okay, your radiated power in a certain direction must be less than some level. So if you have a really high gain on your antenna, then that's bad because then you might have to back off how much power you're transmitting because your gain is too high and that's bad.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. And then, you're saying that because you would just be spewing it in the one direction, that you would have to take everything down total because
FCC. So they'll be like, okay, the limit is 30 dBm at, you know, so usually like you might have a problem at 5 gigahertz because it's the smallest wavelength, which means the antenna is the largest at that frequency, which means the gain's the highest. So typically like the larger your antenna is, the higher the gain. So if you want a really high gain antenna, you need a big antenna. Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, so because 5 gigahertz is the highest frequency, typically like for Wi-Fi, that has the smallest wavelength. So the gain is always higher at 5 gigahertz than it is at 2.4 gigahertz, for instance. So like FCC might say, oh, the peak gain is 30 dBm that we're allowed or the peak radiated power is 30 dBm, which they call EIRP, equivalent isotropic radiated power. They make it complicated for no reason, but that's basically conducted power, which is how much power is coming out of the radio, plus your antenna gain. So if, for instance, you have 8 dB of antenna gain and you're trying to transmit 24 dBm, then you're over the limit and you have to back off the conducted power. And that's bad because you don't actually have antenna gain. The antenna is a passive device. You're always right. radiate less power than what's coming out of your radio. So if your conducted is 24 dBm, you're only, you know, your antenna efficiency is -3. You're only radiating 21 dBm, but you still right. could be over the EIRP limit, which is what they require you to be at. So you have to back off the conducted power. So you have less radiated power coming out. That's bad.
Mm, yep. Also wanted to disambiguate as well. So you've been saying dBs and dBm, and that always confused me as well. So that's okay, dBm, so is 1,000 dBm, less?
It is context-based, but yeah, like, so when you say dBm, you're always referring to milliwatts in power. So 30 dBm is 1 watt, 0 dBm is 1 milliwatt, 10 dBm is 10 milliwatts. But when you're talking about antenna gain or efficiency, those are always dB because it's a strict ratio. There's no like antenna efficiency of dBm. That doesn't make sense. It's always dB because it's ratio of input to output power.
Yeah, that's good. That's good to have that as, you know, as people are listening to, I'm sure that like a lot of this too is like, all right, well, go and read on the antenna theory website. That's just good for this kind of stuff. But yeah, no, that's good. Just as we're talking about these things. Okay. Yeah. And that's a great point about the FCC stuff and how that kind of impacts things in consumer versus the military stuff. Yeah. Are there ever, so you said there, antennas are always passive. So it's always about adding power before that with like an amplification stage. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So in, at least in consumer, like RF and antenna team is two different teams.
Okay.
So RF team focuses on the board level, which is like the radio, all the amplifiers and all this. And then the antenna team focuses on the antenna. So there's like a strict, like DMZ,
oh, yeah.
demilitarized okay. zone between the two teams, yeah. where they focus on the board level, we're focused on the antenna.
Interesting.
And so antenna team works more closely with product design than mechanical engineers, because we're really integrating that antenna, and it's a function of, you know, all the grounding around it, the screws, the flexes, all these things. RF team might work more closely with the EE team.
Right, delivering power, having clean power, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but the RF team and the antenna team don't necessarily need to interact too closely. And again, like on the certification thing, like where the peak gain has to be below, that's an example where they would need to communicate. But RF team focuses on like measuring all their parameters in a 50 ohm system.
Okay.
And the antenna team measures the antenna in a 50 ohm system. And when you hook it up, if both teams get it right, it just works.
Got it. Okay, and that's good to know as well. So that's another thing I've been learning from this book as well. I've read it before and heard it before, but like I said, I haven't been working with it all that much. But the working with 50 ohms as well, I didn't know the origin of that 50 ohms in the past.
Yeah, it has to do with like power handling and loss, like the trade-off between the two or something, right?
Yeah, I think one of the parameters, 30 ohms is the optimum, the other one, 70 ohms is the optimum, so they just split the difference and said 50.
Yeah.
It's fun. That's cool. Okay, so you kind of started talking into the consumer side of things. So after Boeing, you went over to Apple, and obviously a ton of the constraints changed. So what was that like?
It was wild. I mean, going from a place like Boeing, which they have a union for the engineers and product cycles are on the timelines of like 10 years, to Apple, where it's like 1 to 2 years. And, you know, that was crazy. I was just like, wow, things move really fast here. So that was the biggest thing there. But yeah, it was just, totally different. Like, it was we designed the antennas at Apple, you know, like they have an antenna team internally that starts with, you know, hey, we want to put an antenna on this new product, let's figure out what we need to do. And there's no custom antennas that are, like, it has to be custom because they're always coming up with crazy industrial designs for everything.
Right, right.
You know, you can't, like, that's a very good case where you cannot go to DigiKey and buy an antenna and put it in a product and call it good.
Yep. And so, okay, so let's talk about maybe the prototyping process and kind of like walk from prototype through production if you can. Okay.
So, yeah. So I'm going to go high level, like consumer electronics, and say this is how it works. So in general, so near the top, you have the industrial design team. So they're the ones who are like, we want the computer to look like this and to have this materials to feel like this and do this. In conjunction with like the product team, which is like figuring out the business case. But so essentially it starts with industrial design. They have their vision. Like they want an all metal product, no gaps anywhere.
No.
So then, you know, from there, you know, they give it, you know, the product design team, which is mostly mechanical engineers, start like figuring out, okay, how would we make this thing and all this. At the same time, then, like, antenna team will start working with similar sized, similar material, like mock-ups. So it's like, okay, let's say you're doing a computer. And they're like, we want the metal in all these regions. And you're like, well, we're going to need a gap somewhere for the antenna. So you, if they provide no gap at all, then you have to, like, kind of start.
Right. You're like, this is a land-based product now.
Or, you know, like, one thing you have to do is, like, if there's literally no space, you just put in an antenna and do your best, and then you say, hey, look, so given this, the best we could do is an antenna efficiency of minus 20 dB. It's just not going to work.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes, like, you know, you have to do that. And then, you know, in a healthy relationship, there's give and take, and, you know, you say, okay, well, we'd be willing to move some metal away here. Can you get this to work? And so it starts, there's a lot of iteration, yeah. I guess.
Negotiation too, huh?
Negotiation, but yeah, I mean, if everybody's aware of what the goal is, you know, like, for instance, in a cellular phone, you can't ship an antenna that has like minus 10 dB efficiency because they have, like, the carrier sets specs. It's like, it must radiate this much power. So you can't just squash it. So you can't ship it, like, if you just completely ignore the antenna. So.
Okay. So, okay, so now you're at the point where, okay, you have an industrial design, you've negotiated a little bit of plastic or a little bit of a cutout so that you can get an antenna through.
Yeah, you would, at that point, you wouldn't just say, oh, I think it would make it work. You would have, like, a mock-up or a simulation that says, hey, given these volumes, here's what we're going to hit. We're committing to that. Once you're there and you're comfortable, then, or at least, you know, everyone's on the same page, then, you know, then it's about integration, which is, again, just as much, probably more work than the design itself. So the integration is like, okay, well, now we're going to throw in the speaker. And, you know, so you learn, like, what things are the biggest risks. So a speaker is a lot of, you know, plastic and air. So those kind of interact well with an antenna. So if you open up, like, you know, phones, you'll see, like, the speakers and the antennas coexist in the same locations. Yeah. You know, and then, like, oh, okay, we're going to need the power cable is going to go here. What happens when we plug in the power cable? Does it destroy the antenna? What can we do about that?
Because it's a channel of metal, you're saying?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you just start figuring out, like, okay, where's, you know, where do, like, you have, like, the metal on the back of the display, for instance, and the metal on the camera. Like, where are the critical ground points that need to be in there such that the antenna doesn't get degraded as we start, you know, making this from, like, a kind of a mock-up that's just a shell to an actual product.
Yeah. And you mentioned simulation, so that I'm sure that's kind of like you keep revising that throughout time. But what are you using to simulate?
So personally, I'm not a big simulator, but the most common ones are HFSS and CST, I'd say. So I think simulation is good. You always have to confirm it with mock-up because there's no way you can, you know, capture, like, all the, you know, like, some, you might have some loss inside a flex that you can't capture in a simulation. You really need to build it and test it to ensure that. Or, like, you, let's say you have a piece of foam grounding, you know, how do you know that foam is, you know, making the proper contact when it's actually in the product? You can't simulate that as well as you might hope. So simulation is a valuable tool. Like, definitely I shouldn't say you know, it's not, but you definitely have to confirm simulation with a mock-up.
Yeah, it's like a starting point versus the be-all, end-all kind of thing.
Yeah, so some people don't simulate at all, they just go straight to the mock-up because they're like, hey, I can, why do I need to do it that way? And that works, and some people, you know, do it where they rely more heavily on simulation. You know, there's no right way. It's kind of like what people want to do based on their experience. And if you can ship products and you've done it before, then hey, whatever works for you. Right?
So when you're doing you're not doing that much simulation like you do. So what is the alternative then? So it's, you have a mock-up, you have a test antenna in there, and then you just kind of throw it on the bench, or what are we talking about here?
Yeah. So you'll, you know, like pick a product, like,
let's use it like an iPhone if you don't mind talking about that. That'd be great.
We'll talk about a Samsung phone.
Okay. Samsung phone. How about a generic Android phone?
Yeah. Now we're going to talk about a Windows phone. So let's say
that sounds great. How about a Nokia brick phone?
Yes. So you have a Nokia phone, yes. Nokia Windows phone, and it's on your desk. So first of all, there's not that many fundamental types of antennas. Like, they're all basically like,
okay,
hybrids of dipoles, and like a dipole is basically two wires that are in phase and hence radiate, and you start with that and you start like meandering it to fit in the package. And basically, you know, if you've worked on antennas, like if you're designing a cell phone, you should have, and you didn't have exposure before, you would buy like 10 different cell phones, tear them down, and figure out what's working, you know, measure the antennas on those. You know, you'll start to gain some knowledge. You won't have a lot of knowledge because you can tear down like a phone doesn't mean you know what's the critical points in there, like which ground points are critical, which volume, and, you know, like which components of the volume, like the height or the width, are absolutely critical, and, you know, which flex really needed choked and all this different things. You start to learn by doing, but when you're working at Nokia, they give you a phone and you're like, hey, I negotiated this volume. You know, you would essentially just cable it out, which means put a cable on the antenna, ground it to the PCB and all that. So it's, your cable is not influencing the measurement. First thing is you put on a VNA, vector network analyzer. That's where you can see the impedance. So that'll tell you like if it's tuned properly. So like if it's GPS, you'll say, hey, you know, the impedance goes to 50 ohms or whatever. And like basically you'll hear antenna people talk about VSWR, or that's just basically the return loss. Like a VSWR 1 is perfectly matched. So basically you're looking at a plot of VSWR versus frequency. You know, you see, oh, it goes down and it's matched at this frequency, so I can tune it up or down. That first thing just tells you the antenna is accepting power. It doesn't actually tell you it radiates. So there's two things for an antenna to radiate. It has to have a structure that supports radiation, and it also has to be matched to 50 ohms. So with the VNA, you can tell, hey, it's matched. And so we're delivering power to the antenna. But it could also just be absorbing that power. Like if I put a 50 ohm resistor on a VNA, it'll be like, oh, it's really well matched. Cause it was,
right.
Yeah. You know. So once once it's matched, then you would measure, you know, you just go straight to measuring the efficiency. And that's done in an anechoic chamber. So it's just basically, you already have it cabled up, the antenna cabled up in the product. You put it in an anechoic chamber, which measures like how much power is coming out from every direction, essentially, you know, integrates over it and tells you, hey, this is how much power came out. And that's your efficiency.
That's great.
So if you know the efficiency, and then that's done at, you know, whatever number of frequency points you want, but you have your frequency, your efficiency, and your impedance, and that's it. From there, you start iterating.
The frequency, the different frequencies is also interesting to me. So like this Windows phone, it's going to have maybe 2.4 gig for Bluetooth and maybe 5 gig for Wi-Fi as well, like at more advanced Wi-Fi, but then also like a bunch of cellular frequencies and GPS frequencies. How do you get them all? Is it all one package, or like how do you start to cut all these things together?
So Wi-Fi is, at least for the last 10 years, always 2.4 and 5 gig. Typically on these phones, Bluetooth and Wi-Fi share the same radio and the same antenna.
Yep.
GPS is 1.575 gigahertz. That's usually 50-50. It's its own antenna or shared with Wi-Fi or cellular. So there's typically, you know the bands coming in. So it'll be like, okay, we need GPS, Wi-Fi, it might be NFC, and cellular. And they'll tell you the cellular bands. So if you're shipping a phone in the US, it actually used to be much simpler before LTE. There's only like 5 bands. Since LTE came out, so complicated.
Like 15 plus bands.
No, there's
right?
so more. You're like, I defy anybody working on a phone in 2019 to tell me all the bands that are on their phone.
Oh, really?
Actually,
oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. Somebody call me up, an antenna designer, and you can list all the bands on your phone. I'd be pretty impressed. No, it's crazy.
Okay.
But anyway, for an antenna engineer, it doesn't matter because you're like, okay, well, that translates to this set of frequencies. And so therefore, we have to hit this set of frequencies.
It's like 1750 or 1800. Is that one of the, or sorry, like 1.8 gigahertz? Is that?
Yeah. So
that's like one of the frequencies, right? But does it need to be just that one frequency, or can it be like sensitive over, you know, from the 2.4 or sorry, like the 1 point, what the 1 gig up to 3 gig or something like that?
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, you could make an antenna sensitive across a ton of bandwidth. That's good. You don't lose anything.
Good. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You don't lose anything. You know, you might need some filtering there or whatever.
Okay, so it's not the job of the antenna to reject anything, you're saying. You're just trying to make the best transmitter
Correct.
Available, kind of.
Exactly, because filters do a way better job. The antenna is like slow roll-off versus frequency, so you do not use the antenna you don't rely on the antenna for rejection. You have to rely on the filtering.
Got it, okay.
But yeah, so you mentioned like 1850, so yeah. So in that spectrum, like just say 1850, like when I say there's so many bands, like there's probably like 10 different bands that sit on 1850.
Yeah.
Because there's like 2G, 3G, 4G, you know, 5G now, like all these CDMA, all these different ones that sit on the exact same frequency. And then there's like the EU is slightly shifted from.
That's right. Yeah.
US.
Like 1900 and, versus 1850 or something. I remember like I used to deal with these a little bit more, but
yeah.
There's
well,
a lot.
6-7 years ago, like iPhone 1, 2, 3 time, there was only like 4 bands. It was
wow.
Yeah. Like 2 2G bands, 2 3G bands. That was about it. So,
does that end up impacting you other than like make you have to like double check that you make sure you're testing for each of these bands and frequencies?
So if you have a like again in the old days where you just had 2G and 3G, yeah, that just translates into like some frequency range you have to hit. So it's like the low band was like 824 to 960 megahertz, and that included US and EU, and then the high band was like 1710 to 2170. So you would just say, okay, these are the frequencies I care about, and therefore, you know, I need like the target is minus 3 dB efficiency across all those frequencies, and then you don't care. It's like, okay, they can do 2G, 3G, 4G, I don't care, it doesn't affect me.
Got it.
But with LTE now, there's so much bandwidth that they can't, it's really tough to cover all that, so there's like antenna tuners, which are essentially like switches where you can like you think about like an antenna's resonant frequency as a function of its length. So you could switch in like a longer arm or a shorter arm to change the frequency, for instance.
So it's almost like an old school radio where you're like actually turning the dial and it's actually moving like a slider onto something, but it's doing that with digital.
Yeah.
And tapping
essentially, yeah. And then there's also like impedance match tuning where you might put like a series cap or switch in a shunt inductor or something, and like that's another way to tune. But
that's really cool. And so when is that kind of decision made? Is that made during the antenna design phase? Like it's like,
yes.
Okay, we're
so
gonna have 20
well
taps
before
or?
The yeah 20 would be a huge that yeah it's not like that it'd be like
okay.
3 or 4.
I'm pulling many things out of my rear today, Pete.
Yeah.
So just remember that.
Yeah, again, like if you start adding a lot of complexity, like you're gonna have like a lot of extra loss in there, it's gonna be too complicated. You know, the big goal is like you pay people a lot of money to keep things simple.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah,
people
that makes
make stuff hard is that's not good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you antenna design should be fully signed off before they start like going to like a proto build, for instance. Like you just say, I have these switches in place to cover these bands. These are the locations I have. These are the critical points. So we're ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Then, so, you don't like build a prototype or, you know, start making units and you're like, oh, we have to add a switch. That'd be pretty sloppy.
Got it. Okay. And so, like, in prototyping kind of stage, like, what is a prototype? Is it a prototype antenna just copper on flex PCB, or is it printed onto something, or is it part of a circuit board? Like, what does it look like in prototype and then kind of moving up towards production?
There's different ways. So, yeah, the earliest ones, like, you could 3D print. You know, like, let's say somebody wanted to make a phone that's like a triangle or something. Like, you could 3D print that triangle, like, copper tape out where the PCB is, and that's kind of your ground plane. So the ground and the PCB is also, like, part of your antenna. So, yeah, the antenna doesn't just sit alone by itself. That's why you buy an antenna off DigiKey, for instance. It'll say, like, hey, you need a ground plane this size, because that's part of the antenna. But, yeah, so you could 3D print, you know, a triangle layout, copper tape for the ground plane, and then say, okay, well, I'm going to give myself 8 millimeters in this direction for my antenna to keep out, and just start, yeah, cutting copper tape in there and then measuring it as you go. Like, that's a valid way. Okay. You could also simulate it, you know, whatever you want to do.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know. And then how do you start to, like, take other, like, the other stuff in the field of, like, of, not the field of view, but I guess the radiation field of view, or whatever it is called. How do you deal with, like, a hand on a cell phone, or a head on a cell phone? Like, how do you deal with that kind of thing?
So there's a certain amount of, like, loss that they expect in that case. But so, like, the carrier will have specs. Like, hey, you know, you have to radiate this much power when the phone's by itself. When you strap it to someone's head, you know, you radiate this much power, and they might reduce the limit by 3 dB or something. But the way to test is, yeah, they just sell, like, so your hand is just basically a little bit of loss, high dielectric. So you can buy, like, materials that's similar.
Like a fake hand?
Yeah, you can buy a fake hand or a block, whatever, and just strap it to the product and measure the efficiency again.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be hard. You could also simulate.
Yeah. What about the shape of an antenna itself? So, like, I'm thinking with copper tape, at least, it's, like, planar and very flat. You know, there's some thickness to it. But, like, how does that end up impacting the shape of, like, the, not the shape, but I guess the radiation patterns out of this thing? Is it always meant to be, like, the same, like, unidirectional radiation?
Yeah, so ideally you would want that. So, and again, the unidirectional is kind of like a donut pattern. So that would be, like, the lowest. So, like, when you buy an antenna that says Omni, what that means is it's actually, like, a donut-shaped pattern. There's no perfectly spherical antenna radiation patterns. They don't exist. But, yeah, so you look at a phone. So the low band, like, let's say it's, like, 800 megahertz. The half wavelength is, like, 6 inches or whatever. You're actually, the phone itself is less than a half wavelength at the lowest cellular frequency. So I already know, no matter what the antenna designer does, it doesn't matter. It's going to have low gain, low directivity, which means the pattern's going to look kind of like the donut. So okay. It doesn't even matter.
Well, isn't one of the techniques of, like, folding antennas back on themselves and stuff, though, as well?
Yeah, you can meander them, but you're still not going to end up with, like, a super directive antenna. You can't do it. At the higher frequencies, you know, the phone, instead of being, like, less than a half wavelength, it's, like, might be 2 wavelengths long. In that case, you know, yeah, the pattern starts to shift, and they shift in pretty predictable ways. Like, you know, I didn't work on the iPhone 10 in front of me, but I could tell you what the low band radiation pattern looks like because I know the size of it. I know, like, the high end of the spectrum where the phone might be 3 wavelengths long, I know it's, like, the radiation pattern bends back towards the display in a certain direction. And I don't know anything about how they designed it.
Yeah, okay. I think, yeah, like, you kind of start to see the matrix for radiation patterns and such.
Yeah. Actually, I interviewed at Apple, and someone asked me, I was like, what's the polarization on this antenna at low band? And I hadn't worked on cell phones. I was like, well, tell me what the antenna design is. And they were like, you don't need to know. And to answer the question. And I hadn't clicked till later. I was like, oh, okay, now I know why they were asking that. Because they know exactly what it should be. If I'd worked on this, I'd be like, oh, okay, the polarization is this way and the pattern goes like this. Doesn't matter, like, exactly what they did on the inside.
I'm not sure if we'd be able to explain that on audio only, but could you try and explain that a little bit more?
So antennas... Well, like a phone antenna at the lowest frequency, it's fundamentally like a dipole, a half wavelength dipole. Like
sure.
They want it to be, you might think it's more complicated, but it's really not. So one arm of the dipole is the whole back metal, which is like the display and the chassis that forms that. And then the other half is just like a small strip that's usually like, if a phone has a lot of metal, it's actually that metal that is part of there. But there's no way to have a phone, like if you hold it upright, there's no way that the phone is going to be horizontally polarized at the lower frequency.
Oh, I see.
There's no way. It has to, like the current has to flow in the long direction. So
right.
It's automatically, you know, vertically polarized.
Okay.
There's no way to do it otherwise.
Okay. Yeah. That's good to know. That's good to know. So then, so you'd mentioned like, you know, you have antennas that are, across multiple frequencies as well. Are they usually, so say it is all one antenna, somehow you get it all in one antenna. Does that mean that there's just that single element and it is again just a dipole that's looks good for all these frequencies, or what does that look like?
Yeah, so there are definitely, like, you can make an antenna that will cover, like, for instance, 824 to 960, and that'll be the low band. The same antenna will cover like 1710 to 2400. Like, that's definitely been done and doable. So, you know, there's rules in antennas. So I mentioned one of them, which is like the half wavelength. Another rule in antennas is like more volume. The more volume you have, the more bandwidth you have. So when we talk about like a thin dipole, like just two wires, that's a pretty low bandwidth device. But mm-hmm. you could really increase the bandwidth if you start making that dipole wide. So
just thickening, like, up the actual, the width of that strip, you're saying?
Yeah. And not just making it a wire anymore, but like a, think about it like as a, you know, like a whole ground plane for each arm. Mm-hmm. When you start doing that, your bandwidth really gets large.
Yeah. Well, why is that relationship there? I guess I can't.
Why does more bandwidth equals, I guess, like, fundamentally, it's just, if you think about, like, you have a very thin wire, that's, you know, or two wires that form a half wavelength dipole.
Mm-hmm.
There's only like one fixed current mode that can fit on that. There's no like degrees of freedom for the current.
Oh.
But if you know, it's almost like, you know, you have thickened things up, the current has extra paths to go, the resistance drops. Well, it's the same for radiation. Like, you give it extra degrees of freedom for where the current can flow, and there's more modes or more frequencies can kind of fit on that structure and give rise to radiation.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. I mean, because at the end of the day, like you're saying, it is current. It's current moving back and forth, and then that causes radiation to happen. But you're saying that it would be like the equivalent of putting like multiple thin wires next to each other, right?
Essentially.
Yeah. Hmm. And I like never thought about it like that. That's really cool. So now we've done prototyping, we've cut up copper tape, we've tried out different things. What happens then when you're like, okay, you go to production, or you go to even more, you go to FCC testing? How do you modify things as an antenna designer? Like, did you come in with like an X-Acto knife? You're like, nope, snip, 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 snip. Or like,
A lot of times, yes.
Yeah.
So once you have a prototype, if it's a mock-up, you know, from there, like, you got to integrate everything. Like I said, like, all the flexes, like the battery,
mm-hmm.
it's not a, you know, that's going to have a connector on it and all these different things. You know, you have the battery, the camera, mic flex, or just flexible PCB, the button. Like, you're going to have a button right in the middle of your antenna volume, typically.
You know, so. Windows phones have, you know, more than one button, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so you have all those,
multiple buttons
in there. It's just, you keep going with higher degrees of fidelity with a mock-up. You know, eventually, like, when they build it, you know, when I do the first prototype build, it's like a first form factor. It's kind of like the way the product works, and all the teams have their functionality in place. So everybody could... You know, it's the first time everything comes together. You know, at that point, you'll just measure the antenna exactly as I said before, where you cable it out, measure VSWR, measure the efficiency. And typically you'll find like, oh, it's lower than you expect, and you start figuring out why. And that process is just like, okay, I think maybe this flex or this component here is causing me a problem. Very simple. You rip it out, you measure it again. Oh, look, there's 2 dB loss due to that. What can we do to mitigate it? So that might be, then you start like, okay, we need a crown point here, or we need to choke this line. So a choke is just, you know, like a inductor or something on a line that will pass the low frequency and, you know, ideally block or choke the RF frequency. So if the current doesn't flow at RF, it's not going to eat the efficiency. So, you know, that's like a example of a mitigation technique.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a lot of, without having to cut, you can just add something in, you're saying.
Correct. And so like early on, you know, you might have experience with different things and add like placeholders, like, oh, we might need chokes on these lines and we're really going to need grounding here. Or, you know, this is a risk. And so there's a few like builds where you're getting that integration right. And then inevitably things are changing. So at the same time, you know, like the reliability team and the product design team, they have their own specs. Like they want to drop the phone from a meter and it should, you know, like, bounce. Hey, four of them broke. And it's because we need to thicken up this piece here. So then you work with them like, hey, they're like, hey, we're going to change this. And you have to like factor that in or say, okay, yeah, that's fine. No big deal. Or, okay, well, that screws this up. We got to figure out a different way. There's a lot of that. And then by the time you're at cert though, you know, you start testing cert right away. So you can figure out like, you know, what all the issues are. But yeah, I mean, it's basically like every day you're coming in and trying to find the problems, fix them, get ahead of it. And,
Yeah. And it sounds like a lot of like revision tracking type of stuff as well, because things are migrating. Like how far behind the leading edge of the design were you? Like, were you closer to the production side of things or closer to the design side of things when you're moving?
Design for sure. So so it's a lot of work between, you know, the initial concept to getting something ready for production. And then, yeah, we'd be like, antenna engineer would typically be at builds close to production, sometimes production, but really they shouldn't be there at the production build. That's owned by operations team, whose goal is to figure out how to make, you know, from one production line that works, how do we make 30 production lines that work and track all these things.
Right. You have a golden unit they're comparing against probably anyways, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you keep mentioning VNAs, and we alluded to it at the beginning of the episode as well, but you built your own VNA, and I'm not sure if you were using it at work, but you were definitely using it. So could you go through your what it was real quick and why you decided to build one?
Yeah. So I worked as an antenna engineer in consumer electronics, and like there's one lab I worked, everybody had antenna VNA on their desk. And, you know, we'd come in because it was our primary tool. And I was always looking at it, and I was like, why is it so big? Why is it so expensive? They're charging like $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. The CAL kit is like $10,000. And you know, I never quite understood that. Because meanwhile, we're building like, you know, phones that are like $600, but, you know, have much better screens and all this. And then, like, I knew that, like, my phone interacts with the antenna in such a way that it can measure all the magnitude and phase of what's coming to it, because that's how digital communication works.
Right, yeah.
And the VNA was essentially doing the same thing, although a lot more, I guess, sensitive.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, it was something I was like, you know what? I was like, I bet I could build a VNA, or I want to build a VNA. Actually, I went to Maker Faire, and there was this guy who was showing, like, really simple VNA designs that, you know, I went and built at first, which weren't very practical or very reliable, but that's kind of what got me started. I was like, you know what, I'm going to do this. And I didn't know anything about like microcontrollers or I'd never done PCB layout and all this. So that was the basis of a talk at your Hackaday thing that I gave, that's online if anyone wants to see it, but I go through like the whole process. I was just like, look, if I'm going to build a product, I need to do A, B, C, and D. And I just wrote it out. And it was like stuff I'd never done. Like learn how to blink an LED on a microcontroller. Yep. Learn how to, you know, do PCB layout. And then like, I need to make a proto here that accomplishes these goals. And I just made a schedule and then just started knocking it out. It was actually really fun. I learned a ton and I had a much better
I point people idea. To that talk. Well, I just like, the fact that you kept like just saying like, well, and then I just went and figured this thing out. And I'm like, yes. That is awesome. Like, like you did, you just, you know, you kind of went through and you figure out you needed to do a thing like blinking LED, but you know, like each iterative step then was just getting you towards that end goal. But you had the goal in mind too, which was really a good start.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and just like being able to make a board where I put a microcontroller on there, talk to a program into flash an LED. Like when that LED blinked for the first time, I remember just being like,
oh yeah,
so happy. So I was like,
dopamine like crazy.
LED, yeah. I was like, I know how to do the next like 30 things because now I'm controlling this guy. It's like, it's on.
Yeah. Yep. That's great. So what are some of the baseline elements that are in a VNA that you had to actually design? Was it all like buying chipsets and having them kind of do the heavy lifting, or?
Somewhat. So the problem, or I guess the hard part, is to measure the impedance of something at RF, you kind of have to measure like the reflected wave. So impedance and what's reflected from the antenna are the exact same thing. Because like there's an equation that relates the two. So like if you have a 50 ohm line and a 60 ohm antenna, for instance, the reflection coefficient is determined. So if you measure either the reflected wave, it's the same as measuring the impedance. So to get the reflected wave, you have to have a thing called a bidirectional coupler, which essentially like, you know, you're pushing energy to the antenna, but the energy that comes back is what's reflected, and you have to be able to pull that out of the same line. So the bidirectional coupler, you know, basically siphons off some of that reflected energy. And to get that right over a pretty wide bandwidth is pretty tough.
Got it.
So that was a lot of iterations where I was trying, like, you can buy couplers on DigiKey that are cheap or make printed ones on circuit boards that kind of do the same thing. So that was pretty challenging. That's probably one of the fundamental things.
That's like what you're paying for in a good VNA kind of.
I have no idea what's in there. I've never done a teardown.
You're afraid to take apart your expensive piece of gear.
Yeah. So then you have, you know, amplifiers. You have, so you have a frequency synthesizer, for instance, which is another cool little. So you can just buy like a frequency synthesizer that'll work like from, you know, 10 megahertz to 6 gigahertz or whatever. And you just program it with MCU, or you're saying, hey, I want this frequency to come out, and it does. It's really cool.
That is, great.
So the frequency synthesizer puts out the frequency. So like when you want to measure a GPS, for instance, you just say, hey, put out GPS frequency, and then you measure the reflected wave. And
Okay, you're generating a signal, 1.575, whatever it is.
Whatever,
You have to...
Typically, you'd do a sweep over whatever range, but yeah.
Okay. But in the instant, you're outputting this frequency. You have to amplify it as well, I'm guessing.
You don't necessarily need to, but yeah, you can. Depends on.
Then you push it out, the coupler is what actually allows you to siphon off, like you said.
Yeah, so you put an antenna in there. Once you plug an antenna to your VNA, you automatically have reflection there. And that reflection determines.
How do you discern what is reflection versus what you're actually sending out? Because it's all on the same line, right?
Yeah, so there's basically like a coupled line in there that's designed in such a way that it they have a parameter for the coupler that happens to also be called directivity. And it measures like how much more sensitive this line picks up the forward versus the reverse traveling wave. So like a good bidirectional coupler might have a, you know, directivity of 30 dB, which means like the reflected signal is 30 dB stronger than the forward traveling wave. So a lot of it, you know, if you type bidirectional coupler into DigiKey, you can pull up some spec sheets and start looking, and that's pretty much how it's spec'd out.
That's pretty cool.
So then
the stuff that you siphon off, that is the reverse, the stuff coming back, then that just goes into ADC, or what are you actually doing to actually measure that then?
So then you need to know basically the relative phase to the forward wave, because you need magnitude and phase. And so then, yeah, there was a chip that would give me, that would output like a voltage that was proportional to the magnitude, and a different voltage that was proportional to phase. And then, yeah, I would just ADC those lines and get like essentially the, you know, the value for the complex reflection coefficient. And once I have that, I can immediately know the impedance.
That's great.
And so, it's fundamentally simple. It's like you're sweeping through different frequencies, you're stepping through at each step, you measure the magnitude and phase of the reflected wave, and then you get the impedance.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you make it sound simple, and then you even showed it how to build one, and it makes it sound kind of simple too. But it's like, damn, there's a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, and then my big goal was to get it on Kickstarter. I got it on Kickstarter, but yeah, the demand wasn't there. So
yeah,
you know. So I think that's kind of learned why they're so expensive. One is like to get a really high bandwidth thing. Like you need a lot of switches in there, a lot of getting everything exactly right. Like it is pretty challenging. It's not like I'll make a VNA, done.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it's just, you know, it's not like phones where you're going to sell, you know, 20 million a year. You're going to sell like 200 a year.
Right.
So,
right.
You know.
So, and you're like already competing in the lower end market versus something higher margin. So,
yeah. So, okay. Yeah, ultimately I met the goal of putting it on Kickstarter, offered it for sale, got bunch of orders, which was cool, but didn't hit the target, so I decided, hey, I got my VNA, I'm keeping it.
That's great. And you still use it?
Yeah, I do. Yeah,
that's great. That's great. Yeah. How does it compare to like what is the frequency range of the VNA that you built?
It's like 400 megahertz to 2.7 gigahertz. So if I'm doing like you know, Bluetooth or something, or cellular, like low band cellular, high band cellular, I can do that. But yeah, it's just mainly my house. It's super light, which is cool. Like it's the size of like, you know, like a big iPhone. Whereas like, you know, professional VNAs are so big, you're going to have to hurt your back.
Yeah, right, right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, that is nice to be able to, and like, probably bring it to a meeting and pull it out and show someone and be like, they'd be like, wait, what is that?
Yeah.
That's great. So, I mean, you're doing consumer level stuff now. I mean, you mentioned there's, you know, VNAs are a big tool there. Are there other tools that you find yourself using on a daily basis that people should know about?
I mean, besides rework equipment, like, you know, if you're an antenna engineer, you need to be able to solder O201s and such for your impedance matching. And, but yeah, so if you have an anechoic chamber, you can measure the efficiency. If you have a VNA, you can measure your impedance. And also if you have multi-antenna systems, you can measure the isolation, which is like if you put in energy into one antenna, how much does the other antenna absorb?
Okay.
That's another important parameter for multi-antenna systems. But yeah, VNA and a chamber is fundamentally all you need. You could also add simulation tools if you want.
How big are the chambers that you would use on just testing versus like a FCC certification type thing?
So they can be pretty small. Like there's a company, Satomo, that makes one that's only about a 9-foot cube. And that one, so that's a smaller one, but it will do cellular. So the size of the chamber you need is really a function of the wavelength again. Okay. So if you're doing like 60 gigahertz millimeter wave stuff, you might need like a chamber that could fit on a desk. It's much smaller. But yeah, the ones in consumer typically use are, you know, 9 to 13 feet on a side for a cube.
Yeah, like room sized.
Yeah. FCC, yeah, they get really big, like 5-meter chambers. And that's just because they measure super low frequencies. Like you got to measure the radiated emissions at, you know, 2 megahertz.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I always figured that was because they also drive like bigger things and they might have like larger devices in there as well. But I guess that's, that's pretty cool. Well, Pete, what else should we know about you and antenna theory and, you know, your background? Is there anything else we missed?
Geez, I don't know.
Your whole life, just, you know, like condensed down to an hour, you know? Like,
yeah. I'm working on putting a rocket on a balloon.
Oh, yeah?
Lighting the rocket when the balloon's up. So I made a Raspberry Pi that, battery powered Raspberry Pi that just waits for a certain amount of time and then turns on a switch, which fires a little igniter, which I'm going to put on a rocket that's on a balloon. So, that's a project I'm working on.
Okay. And the rocket is going just up further, or what's the deal?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. Like, I don't understand why. So, the biggest thing in rockets is even bigger than gravity is wind resistance. And it's like when you get to 100,000 feet, it's like less than 1,000th, I think, the air density.
And what's that in dB? So,
30 dB.
There you go.
But yeah, that's a good catch. So I had this idea. And it turns out other people have had the idea and done it. But So I'm kind of doing something that's been done before, but
yeah, no reason not to do it though. That's cool.
Yeah. So I still, so like little things, like I put a GoPro on the balloon and it has to work. It's like minus 40 degrees in there. So I make sure I run my GoPro in my freezer and figure out how to insulate it. So I literally have a GoPro in my freezer at home and I'm like recording to make sure like what type of insulation to keep it working longer.
That's great.
So I do a lot of stupid stuff like that.
No, it's super fun though. It's super fun. Yeah. And like, are you just trying to get the rocket higher to get like more curvature out of a picture kind of thing?
Yeah, there's not a super big goal right now. It's just like, you know, I've wanted to do the balloon experiment, which people do where you, like, you can take a balloon up to 100,000 feet
and then
it pops, a parachute goes and you go and get it.
So yeah.
You don't do that. And then the rocket is just, I got into rocketry as well. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Just combine the two. Yeah,
that's great. That's great. And plus, you know, the antennas are going to be really good on those things. Phone and
yeah, they're going to be fantastic.
Well, Pete, this has been great. Where can people find you and more about you online?
Go to antennatheory.com. So everybody, you know, if you're like, hey, what you said here wasn't right or don't agree, want more information, feel free to ping me by emails on the website. But yeah, this is my two cents on antenna engineering.
It's awesome.
My take based on my experiences.
That's
great. Thanks for having me. You know, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's like chatting about antennas. So.
Yeah. Well, definitely. I'm probably going to give you a call sometime soon with lots of questions to bend your ear about it. So.
Okay. Cool. All right.
Thanks, Pete.
All right. Thank you.
Once again, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Rohde & Schwarz, a leading manufacturer of value instruments designed to help you maximize your bench's performance for everyday applications. They just announced an industry first. Complete solutions with all the upgrades up front for one price. Now through December 31st, save up to $10,000 on Rohde & Schwarz solution packages that come with fully loaded test and measurement instruments right from the start. When you invest in Rohde & Schwarz products, you get the highest quality engineering, plus all the bandwidth, channels, inputs, memory interfaces, and signal generation you'll ever need. Learn more about Rohde & Schwarz value instruments and this limited time promotion at askanengineer.us. That's askanengineer.us.